welcome back to a new episode of Geeks at Large. It's been another fucking month or so since we released something.
They won't let me outside.
We're so fucking busy.
Well, there are those ongoing rumors that we all secretly hate each other and our contracts are about to expire, so we don't actually need to keep pretending to like each other.
That's Shut true. We're all up, we're all the Catherine
Heigl. I mean, that's not true.
Great Anatomy.
Our friendship hasn't been the same since I ran over Neil's secret wife.
You fucking bastard. Ling Ling will never forgive you. Her spirit will never move on.
I know her spirit will never move on. I see it every time I look in the mirror. She keeps chanting revenge in Mandarin.
Neil's secretly the warden guy from Orange is the New Black. Wife.
I mean, wait, never mind.
I didn't intend to run over Ling Ling with my car repeatedly as she was on fire. It just sort of happened that way.
You touch Olga, I swear to God, I will get mildly perturbed at you.
So do you have two wives?
Well, no, he ran over Ling Ling, remember? Olga's my new one.
Are you just the warden from fucking Orange is the New Black?
No, I'm the warden from fucking Sucker Punch.
He had a very, very good warranty on his first wife, so and he didn't void it when I accidentally murdered Ling Ling, so
North Korea may be a fucking shithole, but their warranties on wives are great.
See, when you say Ling Ling, I just think that it's a fucking panda and Neil was married to a fucking panda.
You know what? Maybe she was a panda. Fuck you.
My companda.
Oh, fuck. Alright.
Why is that not a website yet for Chinese brides? Mycompanda.com.
Because it's a Venture Brothers reference.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so.
Still the points will fit. I will make that website and make millions. You know the social network? Ahead. Imagine that if they were selling brides on the internet.
Or we can just tell Last Week Tonight to do it because they've just been cranking out fucking websites.
That's true, they have.
I'm pretty sure John Oliver occasionally just goes into a weird fugue state, and when he comes out, he goes, oh, well, I've registered 97 domain names.
Like, I'm honestly surprised that Last Week Tonight doesn't have, like, 70, like, startup app companies for various apps.
Yeah, I wouldn't
surprise. Just for the sake of a joke.
Wouldn't surprise
but
me at all.
Either. Anyway, so yes, it is October, and actually, to date this episode, it's fucking Back to the Future Day, Neil.
God, shut up. God.
Why do you all keep falling for that? If it says it's Back to the Future Day on the internet, it's not Back to the Future Day. God, you're also stupid.
Yeah, I know. That has run through my mind multiple times today. Like, what if they got it wrong, and then I can laugh at everyone?
Like, it was actually, like, October 20th, and they missed it. Oh, that fucking Ukina Joe thing about Star Wars Day. You remember that? Where it's like, it's Star Wars Day, May the 4th be with you. And then some guy's like, it's May the 5th. And he's like, oh, I missed it. And, like, cries.
Yeah, that'd be great, actually. Just to rub it in all my friends' faces. Ugh.
But have you guys been up to anything cool lately?
Well, okay, Michael J. Fox showed up in an alley and I accidentally beat him to death.
Jesus fucking Christ, Casey.
So no. Let's see. I finished editing a documentary about Atlanta comedian Jerry Farber. And we just submitted it to a handful of festivals. It's called Geriatric. And get it? Sorry.
Is he old?
Yeah. No, he's incredible. He's like 75.
Oh, okay. So it makes sense.
Yeah. So I just threw out that word, that term, one time we were at a meeting. And I just said, Geriatric. It's the title now.
And then just like, there's like some like inspiring music playing. And like a zoom in on like, I don't know, the director, whatever they are.
What is this, an Aaron Sorkin script?
Yeah, and it's just like, oh my God, that's it.
And Republicans are wrong, and then there you go, it's an Aaron Sorkin script. So we just got that finished, we got that submitted. We're doing some more work on Sweet Weenie, which is the sketch comedy channel that other Geeks at Large, or former Geeks at College.
Us, our group.
Yeah, us. Are involved with
our crew,
so we're trying to get more stuff done on that. But we've actually gotten some things filmed, and we should go live within the next week or two. So that should be exciting.
And I once gave
you guys a free idea.
It's true, you did. We've actually been trying to toy around to see what we can do with that one.
Oh, cool.
Steve,
even like
I've
this.
I've given a couple little ideas.
True, Taylor has, and they were all terrible. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know.
I once mailed you a pair of tube socks.
Like, should I tell Casey, like, our one, like, little idea that we just talked about? Where, okay, Casey, so it's basically, like, it's going to be, like, I don't know, it could be, like, a vine, really. Where it's, like, Neil peeks around, where he's, like, drop everything and come see this, Taylor. And I'm, like, holding, like, Fabergé eggs. And, like, priceless heirlooms.
I just did a spit take.
See, it works!
Yay! We had this
I'm not sure if it should just be me, like actually dropping them, or just being like,
knowing us at Sweet Weenie, I would say do both, and one of them will get put in an outtakes reel.
Yeah,
okay. That's actually
and the outtakes reel will be roughly 8 times the length of the actual video.
Yeah. The outtake reel for our first video is actually like at least three times longer than the actual video itself.
But anyways, anything else cool?
They were filming for 9 hours.
Filmed for a while. No, that's about it, really. That's about it. Taylor, you said you had some exciting stuff.
Yeah, I'm actually doing shit now, I guess, kind of, maybe.
Oh, I thought I was going to answer after Neil.
I don't know. You fucking said that. I don't know. Neil, what
you said that you fucking stabbed Michael J. Fox to death in an alley.
You lost your
privileges. I said I beat him to death, Neil. Let's be specific here. I said I beat him to death.
Only to coroners does that make a difference.
No, yeah, I don't really have much going on anyway.
Okay, see, shut up, Casey. It's my turn.
Taylor, continue.
Okay. Yeah, so I've had a couple of things. I've had a couple things get released that I was in. Comic book projects and stuff. And I'm going to include them in the description for this episode. One of them was I was approached by an editor at Viz to be a part of a charity art book called Art for Hope Nepal, which is now available in like all digital bookstores, including Comixology and iBooks and all that stuff. I'll link to the Comixology one specifically, but it's really cool. There's a bunch of, you know, really talented artists from across the comic book industry, including SCAD alum Ian McGinty, who's worked on Boom Studio stuff like Adventure Time and Bravest Warriors. He has his own comic coming out called Welcome to Showside now, which is really cool. And it's just $5. So $5 you get, I don't know, about like 50 pieces of artwork to look at in a nice digital art book. So
$5 could also get you the world's worst hand job you've ever had.
Yes.
Sorry.
God fucking damn, Neil. Nothing more appropriate to say in a plug for a charity art book for victims of the Nepalese earthquakes earlier.
Actually, I had a way worse one that I didn't say.
Well, don't say that. That just makes you seem worse than you are.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, like, I think everyone on this podcast knows I'm a piece of shit. So,
I guess you're right. Anyway, you're right.
Art for Nepal. That's awesome. What else you got?
And I am currently part of a Kickstarter that, as of this day, has about 25 days left on it. It's for a Mad Max Fury Road fanzine, and it's really cool. There's over 70 artists. Some people submitted multiple ones, but I did a nice like 11 by the original artwork is 11 by 17, but the book's gonna be much smaller than that. But it's just various illustrations and fan art for Mad Max Fury Road. So I'll also include the link to that Kickstarter. I did kind of a cool movie poster.
It was very nice. I really liked it.
Thank you. I'm thinking of doing prints or something like that, like selling that.
Sure.
So it was above average.
Thanks, Casey.
Casey's just mad because we wouldn't let him tell more tales of running over Michael J. Fox to death with his own goddamn DeLorean.
I was also going to tell about the actual professional thing that happened to me, Neil.
You're the one that said you didn't have much to talk about.
Did you get Michael J. Fox's business card before you repeatedly bludgeoned him to death?
As you said, this is for leaving Spin City.
I got it afterwards, Neil.
Okay, you pried it from his back pocket?
It fell out.
Okay, Casey, yeah, what's your
fine.
Thing?
That's fine with me.
No, I met with somebody today who was in town looking for a writer to help them on a project they're working on, and we hit it off and talked about Star Trek. We geeked out a little bit, and now I'm on that project.
Yay!
Oh, shit.
That is very exciting.
Yeah.
It's like the sequel to the documentary that Neil edited or something like that.
Yeah, they were like, listen, this documentary was just fucking shit.
Especially how it was edited. It was awful.
Yeah, the editing. we're just gonna make shit.
Listen, we tried to do a documentary on this guy, and the documentary was the worst edited piece of crap. The editor literally murdered this thing in cold blood and drowned its corpse. Yep. So we want you to write a fictional version of it, because no matter what you do, the bar has already been set so low by that editor.
How can you murder something and then drown it unless that thing is Rasputin? Did you just call my documentary Rasputin?
I was just trying to find new ways of saying that you did bad, Neil.
I'm just kidding. I called my documentary Rasputin.
And they're even like, this guy wanted to call it geriatric. We just kind of went with it as like a pity move, you know, whatever.
We just encouraged him because we felt sorry for him. And then he made it the title, and we don't know what to do now.
Like, we tried murdering him, but we just, it's too messy, man.
And we tried drowning him, and that didn't take either. Anyway, so it's safe to say
whenever we talk with him, it's like when Lenny asked George to tell him about the rabbits.
God damn it! So it sounds like we've all been pretty productive. So that was exciting,
you know, relatively so compared to versus like most people in the world,
as opposed to Casey, you know, like. Spoon feeding Michael J. Fox poison. You ever notice that I'm changing repeatedly the methods of murder?
No, thanks for explaining the joke, Neil.
That's the joke. You're welcome.
I'm gonna be really horrified if, in an unrelated series of events, Michael J. Fox turns up dead in the next few days.
Wouldn't it be hilarious?
Be fucking
awful.
Sad.
Wouldn't it be hilarious and awful, but also sort of hilarious if he died on Back to the Future Day?
But don't sweat it, Casey. Neil and I will make sure.
No, Neil, it'd be tragic. Now, if he got run over by a crazed fan and a DeLorean by mistake, then it'd be hilarious.
Now, don't worry, Casey, because Neil and I are going to make sure that you're going to be the prime suspect.
That's true.
So
we've cut off your hair and sprinkled it all over the world.
That's where Casey's like giant like shaved portion of his head.
Yeah. In case you were wondering why your head was cold when you woke up this morning, it's because
shows what you know. People have been doing that for years. Yeah, scientists every time scientists do a forensic analysis, they have to attribute for the fact that likely one of my hairs was in that room at the time.
That's true. They may have gotten the hairs on your head, but did you notice that it felt a little cold downstairs?
You mean my shoulders?
Yes.
My back?
Anyways.
Hairs that grow on my toes?
No. All right.
Anyways, okay, anyway.
My joke has failed horribly, so.
Anyway.
And so you murdered it, Casey, just like cool you murdered things. Michael J. Fox, hypothetically.
We got a couple cool things to talk about. We're going to first talk about, you know, the Star Wars trailer, because how can we fucking not?
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of a break.
And... you know, since this is going to be more or less our Halloween episode, we're going to try out a new little segment that was Casey's brainchild. It's like he's been wanting to do it, not necessarily on this subject for months, but...
disfigured child.
Like, so we're going to do that.
Do you have an issue with the idea of me producing children, Neil?
Because
if so, the Catholic Church totally agrees with you. Don't get me wrong.
It's the kind of child that you look at and wince and call it special because you're too afraid to call it apocalyptically ugly. Anyway.
I'm thinking, like, what would Casey Gerard's brainchild be like? And it's that scene from The Fly where Brundle Fly comes out of the telepod when he's fused together with the other one.
Crazy Fly. Anyways.
So, Star Wars. So, really. How about a Star Wars? How was that? How would you guys like a Star Wars?
Okay, so, a few months ago, I made this joke about how, you know, that line from Arrested Development, here's $5, go see a Star Wars, was going to be relevant again. And now everyone's saying it. And it's like, man, I said that months ago.
I've whatever. Never heard ahead of that the curve, ever. You know,
from me. Well, you probably didn't hear it from me. I probably didn't tell you. You probably didn't talk about it.
He was too ahead of the curve, Neil.
I know. Anyways, I thought the trailer was really cool.
Mm-hmm. Me and Casey both cried.
Did you really?
Yeah, I got misty-eyed.
I did not
get I had to explain to my roommate and her boyfriend why I was why I had tears rolling down my face.
Oh, really? I thought you said, like, when we talked about it on Facebook, you were like, it was pretty good, I suppose. I was like, oh, did you not really care for it? I didn't know I was being duped.
Duped. That's a fun word.
I'm trying to retain it in so I don't seem so utterly pathetically dissolving into being a man-child.
Oh, that's
well,
totally fine.
But here's the thing is that, like, it's okay to be excited for it. You
yeah,
know?
Absolutely.
I mean, and I don't think
we all are.
I don't think it's wrong or, you know, unrealistic to be emotional like we were.
Yeah.
Once the fucking Rebel Fleet song comes in with the fucking Falcon flying.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
I was just like, you know what? Fuck you guys.
Fuck everyone.
And then I started to cry a little bit. So, but and then Casey and I just freaked out. We were just like, we were texting each other on Facebook. I was like, man, how about those characters? How about that? Like Casey had the thing, like that shot of Poe and Finn when they walk by the X-wing has more chemistry than the entire prequel trilogy. And I'm
man,
like, yep.
Man, how about those sets? Man,
those
how
sets.
About those matte paintings? Man. How about that dynamic cinematography?
I know,
that
right?
That is the key word I've been using to describe this dynamic cinematography. Like, in all honesty, the scene where Oscar Isaac actually just goes by and he just pats John Boyega on the back.
There was more movement in that scene than anything in the prequels.
And even that, it's not even just the ones that have movement. In the second trailer, there's a scene where Daisy Ridley reaches out her hand and John Boyega grabs it. Again, more chemistry in that shot than the entire
prequel. Well, and there's a variety of shots. Stage. There's close-ups. There's, you know, tracking shots. There's pretty, like, I don't want to say it's seamless, but it's, like, really good integration of CG. You know, I like how even like some of the scenarios are setting up, like there's going to be ground battles going on while there's an air, you know, dogfights going on, which has never happened in Star Wars and you can actually do now.
Yeah,
that's exciting. I think like, you know, that the X-Wings are CG in a lot of the shots, like the ones just flying over that lake. But it looks
nice.
But
that's a gorgeous shot.
It's nice. Yeah. Like that. Like
yeah,
so much of CG
it's actually
has
creative.
Yeah, so much of CG hinges on, like, cinematography. Like, look at fucking Gravity. You know, Gravity is almost entirely CG. It's probably, like, what, 90% CG?
Yeah.
But you don't care because it's filmed well and it's integrated well. So,
it's,
and that's what this, it feels like this movie's doing.
It's not trying to distract your attention from the movie. It's trying to enhance the movie.
Exactly.
It's a big story. That's a big problem. Or that's a big thing. I was really worried that they were gonna start doing trailers with more plot elements, you know, and they would I was worried that they would stop going for the nostalgia throat, and I was really happy that they did with this one. It was like they weren't trying to appeal to my 15-year-old self anymore, to like my 7-year-old self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to say, like, okay, listen, here's what the movie actually is. And you know what? I'm liking what I'm seeing. It's great.
Well, yeah, and it's like, there's nostalgia in it, but it reminds me, ironically, of J.J. Abrams' Star Trek film.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's nostalgia, but it's not like pandering, you know, wink, wink, all the time nostalgia. And we don't know. I mean,
it's nostalgia that isn't going into the darkness of nostalgia.
Yeah.
Thank
it's
you for
not...
that very subtle reference, Casey.
God,
but you liked my reference to Star Trek Insurrection?
Yeah, totally. That's, yeah.
I thought the reference to Wrath of Khan in your joke was a little tasteless.
It was forced.
Don't
it was
you...
almost like it's almost like Casey just did it because people saw that movie and it was a superior, you know, thing. So
I would say that joke was a little forced. Speaking of Star Wars,
I thought that's where you're going. Actually, too, like that joke seemed a little forced, but it did awaken an idea in my head. Let's talk about the
force. No, mine wouldn't be as clever. It'd be like that was sure forced. Awakens.
Yeah, it's true. That's like Taylor. That's like a staple of Taylor's puns.
Yeah. So, what else can we say? I like, shit. It's like I'm blanking now.
No Jar Jar. That was a big. I saw no couches for people to sit on. That was a big one. Okay, so one of the things that I did is, and this I probably should have said this earlier, but this is relevant, I promise. I went and saw a show down in Stone Mountain called the One Man Star Wars Show, or One Man Star Wars Trilogy, which is a man reenacting the Star Wars trilogy by himself in an hour. And it's exactly what it sounds like. And it was wonderful. And I saw this show literally 10 years ago. And it was great. And it was great to see it again. Like, you know, 10 years later, you know, I'm not 15 anymore. I'm 25. And I actually got to talk to the guy. And he and I got along like a house on fire. He was recommending me, you know, bad Lifetime movies. Apparently his wife did paintings for a Lifetime movie that I have the name of that I need to go watch with the rest of the Sweet Rainy crew.
What's the movie?
But what's that?
What's the movie?
I don't know the name of it right now. I have it written somewhere, so I'll look it up. And
such a tease.
One of the things that I told him was that there are two things that I want to see from you. I would pay good money to see these. One is the One Man Star Wars prequel trilogy, because that's going to be really easy for you. All you have to do is sit on a couch. It's just an hour of you sitting on a couch.
No, Neil, to be fair, occasionally he has to stand up, walk dramatically away, turn around, and go back to the couch.
Maybe there's a window for him to look at for a moment.
I mean,
And then I told him I wanted to see the One Man Mad Max series, because I told him I would give you my entire life savings to watch you reenact Fury Road on your own.
just like one way. Like, for half of the reenactment, he's facing one direction, and then for the rest, he's facing the other.
It's just him running around the stage. And he dies of a heart attack on the first showing. but that was something that I told him, I want these to happen. I want these to happen because of you. So, yeah, that was relevant, I promise. Also, really, really nice guy. If it's playing around you, it's the One Man Star Wars trilogy by a Canadian actor named Charles Ross. Fantastically nice guy, fantastically talented guy. Go check out the show. Anyways, Star Wars trailer, fantastic. Great. Yes. I initially was really worried about watching it because, frankly, I feel like everything has been going out of its way to spoil the movie for me. Like, I see so many goddamn articles about how, is Luke Skywalker actually Kylo Ren? I'm like, I don't know. Why don't we wait until the fucking movie comes out?
Well, I mean, that'd be kind of fucking stupid because isn't Adam Driver Kylo Ren?
Well, also, it's Adam Driver. And then they're like, Adam Driver's playing Kylo Ren. It's like, maybe I wanted to wait and find out that it was him, you pieces of shit.
Well, that was known for a while.
That's a cast listing of the press release.
I was hiding. I'm sorry. This is what I get.
Maybe Adam Driver was grown in a lab and it's going to reveal that he's actually Mark Hamill's clone. Not the actual character, like actually Mark Hamill's clone.
They could have just casted his son.
The other day I googled Dom Long Gleason because I needed a new Facebook profile picture, and one of the things I found was so many people were suggesting that he was going to be a young Luke Skywalker because of how much he looks like Mark Hamill, and I don't see it at all.
I don't see it at all either.
This Tumblr, they are known to be delusional.
You know what I like to call, because, you know, I've seen there's photos of Dom Hall Gleason and he seems to be with they're not called the Empire anymore. They're called something. The First Order. I like to call him Ginger Hitler. Because that's like what he is.
Yeah, it's like, you're not wrong. And yeah. I love it because I could easily cosplay him.
Yeah, you could easily just be Ginger Hitler. That's his name. Like, I don't know what his real name is.
It's general something or other. Honestly,
general something or other.
Well, the thing is, tells me so much. Here's the other thing. My main two fears about this movie at this point is because I'm not really worried it's going to be bad. Even if it's bad, I'm expecting it to be like Pirates of the Caribbean sequel level of, well, that wasn't good. But it's not going to be the prequels. It's going to pass that because that's the lowest bar. The only way that you could possibly get below that bar is if you actually had to jump under it.
Well, that's the thing. It's like everyone's like, please don't be bad. I'm like, guys, this could be a disappointment and it could be fucking still miles better than the prequels because of all the shit we just seen. Like, the trailers are better than the fucking prequels.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Okay, to be fair, the trailer for episode 1 is fucking glorious, even by today's standards, only because it actually got me excited for that movie.
But the other thing is, I'm looking at it, I would put money on it, Domhnall Gleeson's going to die in this movie, and I'm uncomfortable with that because I'm not sure I'm comfortable seeing a guy who looks like me die.
Well, you know, I look like Chris Pratt, so I don't have to worry about me dying.
Yeah, no one's going to ever kill off Chris Pratt. God isn't even going to kill off Chris Pratt.
just be immortal.
Chris Pratt's just going to be dancing around the ruins of society to come and get your love, and no one's going to have the heart to stop.
Anna Faris is going to be like in her mid-70s and, you know, look it, and he's just going to look like how he's always been.
Yeah, he's going to look great. It's going to be fantastic.
And the other fear is, what if he's the Jar Jar Binks of this movie?
I don't think...
Domhnall Gleeson?
Yes.
I don't think you have to worry about that. I think it's safe to say.
Like, he straight up just talks like him.
Yes. I imagine what if Domhnall Gleeson just walks in and goes, Misa don't know nothing about birth and no baby.
I'm fucking leaving this podcast now after that. There's no coming back.
Misa, the head of the First Order.
So I was really worried about watching the trailer because I've been trying to not spoil myself for anything.
But what's so great is that there's like very little context for anything. But one of my favorite things about the trailer, and this is just like a little touches, like I love one, you know, they imply that there's going to be a sort like a lightsaber duel between Finn and Kylo Ren, and I like the location. It seems like a real location for starters. Yeah. That's nice.
It's a photogenic location.
That's true. And I also like how it's pretty clear that Finn's over his head. He doesn't really know how to use a lightsaber.
Well, like, visually, you just get that. Like, just from that one shot, you can tell he is clearly over in his head.
From his body language.
What do you mean, like, putting information in your frame? Like, who the fuck
does
that?
Show and not tell. It's amazing.
Who the fuck does that?
But it just shows me that it's not just going to be like some crazy video game cutscene, like the end of, you know, Revenge of the Sith, you know.
God.
So, like, and that's cool. And
Just a moment. I started watching the end fight in Revenge of the Sith 10 years ago. It's about to wrap up, guys.
But when we see Kylo Ren use his lightsaber, it's like he doesn't use it in like stupid, you know, super choreographed ways. He, like, cut something or somebody, you know. He feels more like... it's like they're using his presence more, like... It's very reminiscent of Darth Vader, which I'm sure is very, you know, on purpose.
Yeah.
But I like that. And it's not just like, oh, man, here's a fucking, you know, clone of Darth Vader. Like, I'm sure there's going to be other stuff going on with him.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But, well,
I think just a lot of it too is like it just gives me faith in the movie on who's working on it. You know, like isn't Lawrence Kasdan either doing the script or doing like
he wrote
supervising
it.
The script?
I think he's getting the final credit.
Yeah. So shit, man, you got Lawrence Kasdan who's written other really good movies. So, which is better than the prequels, who are all written by one man.
No. There was a co-writer on Attack of the Clones.
I refuse to believe this.
Previously, he worked on Young Indiana Jones, and apparently George Lucas brought him on because he felt like he couldn't write convincing enough love dialogue, and he wanted someone else to bump it up. So I want to make that clear. The love dialogue in Attack of the Clones is somebody who is done by a dialogue editor who wanted to punch it up because it make it better than it previously was.
I don't know if that makes that writer look worse or fucking George Lucas when he needed his dialogue bumped up to the level that it was bumped up to. Like, oh shit, I can only polish a turd so much. Why is he talking about sand?
Someone looked at that script, you know, at the romantic dialogue and said, yeah, this is okay. I can imagine getting hard talking to someone like this.
And even three has some that are just like, I'm in love. No, I'm it's because so I'm so in love with you.
God.
It's like the fucking worst. Neil, did I tell you that? I know I told Casey this because you can find the entirety of Genndy Tartakovsky's Clone Wars on YouTube. It's like, I don't know, an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours.
Okay.
Have you seen it before?
I've only seen a little bit of...
Oh my god, please fucking watch it, because it's probably the best thing ever related to the prequels, ever.
I know I thought the animation was, like, gorgeous.
Well, because it's Genndy Tartakovsky, who did Dexter's Lab, and Samurai Jack, and Symbiotic Titan, and Hotel Transylvania movies. And it's just like, oh man, if you actually use like great visual storytelling with these, you can make something that's actually pretty good, you know.
And then you have George Lucas.
Well, that's the thing, and in the Clone Wars, you actually can buy the fact that Obi-Wan and Anakin were friends.
Yeah,
you know, you can,
as opposed to being told sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Hey,
he rescued him
from that nest of Gundarks.
There's great cinematography for, you know, an animated film. Mm-hmm. There's whole like scenes and sequences that follow just clone troopers, they're actually really, really great.
Yeah.
There's an entire sequence that follows Mace Windu as he's fighting droids and stuff, and it actually is like, oh yeah, Mace Windu is actually supposed to be, you know, really good. And one of the best things ever in a Star Wars sequence, as far as I'm a Star Wars thing, like a visual, you know, TV show, movie, whatever, is the introduction of General Grievous.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yes, it's so fucking good, and it gets everything right that the prequels got wrong. It's super tense. It's basically like 4 or 5 Jedi, including a Padawan. You know the dude who has a super tall forehead and the beard?
Yeah.
That Jedi, he's in there.
Okay.
And, like, they're basically just surrounded by all these droids in, like, this fallen ship. And they're just hiding. And then it just all goes silent. And you hear, like, you know, the sounds of Grievous walking. It also explains why he has, like, that wheeze and the cough.
Yeah.
You know, when you said, and it has that, you know, Jedi with the super tall head and the beard, I imagine Chris somewhere out there went, it's Kennedy Mundi.
Well, then there you go. That's his name. Yeah. I hate how it's not canon, because like the second season or the third season or whatever it is, it's really confusing. But the tail end of it is a direct lead up to Revenge of the Sith.
No, and I'm sure that was like a decision handed down from higher up saying, because in fact, that's the reason I was one of those people who wasn't confused by the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, because I had watched everything leading up to it.
Exactly.
And I cannot imagine going to that movie completely dry, not knowing what happened beforehand. Otherwise, it would just seem like, wait, what?
And it's really intense. Like, the whole chase scene where, I forget what her name is, but she's the red-skinned...
Shakti?
Yeah, Shakti, yeah.
God, why do I remember that?
And she's awesome. Like, she's fucking great. And she was there with the other Jedi in the original scene that introduces General Grievous. So she kind of carries his baggage with it. And she's just trying to, you know, get Palpatine away from Grievous, and it's fucking intense, and it's better than anything in the prequels. So please, if you haven't watched Genndy Tartakovsky's Clone Wars, go watch him, please, including Neil.
Yeah, no, I'm going to. Well, yeah. Tonight, I'm flip-flopping between what I want to watch. I'm either going to watch that documentary about sleep paralysis on Netflix that apparently is, like, fucking terrifying.
I've heard it's okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of a bummer. I'm either going to rent Nightmare on Elm Street so I can watch it with the commentary, the Red Letter Media commentary, or I might watch Clone Wars.
Okay. And Clone Wars is in HD, by the way.
Yay!
Someone just put the whole thing on in HD, because the thing's hard to find. It's like out of print, I think.
Yeah, I'm one of the only people I know who actually has it.
Yeah, so there you go. So
Maybe this is a right that will be wrong.
The Force Awakens trailer was great, and if you haven't, go watch fucking Clone Wars, because it's awesome.
So, yeah, there you go. Star Wars is great. It's going to be good. I'm hoping so. Please, for the love of God.
And you could also watch Citizen Kane tonight, Neil, but whatever works for you.
Fuck you. No, that's my one thing that I kind of have reservations about. Everyone's like, buy the Star Wars merchandise. Get your ticket pre-ordered, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to buy any of their merchandise until I figure out that the movie's good. And mm-hmm. also, can't I just wait a week or so before I see it? Because there's no way you're going to get anywhere near the vicinity of a theater that night, like that
exactly.
weekend.
Yeah.
So,
So, moving on.
Okay.
We are proud to introduce what hopefully can be a running segment on Geeks at Large. As I mentioned, was the aforementioned brainchild of Casey Girard, which is
the dark creations of a madman.
Which is what would we call it, Casey? We call it what you
at this point. It's tentatively titled "What You Can Learn From
Ellipses."
Yeah, what you can learn from epilepsy.
Yes. And seeing that it is spooky time, October, whatever. Official pending trademark. I approached Casey like, why don't we do one of these? You know, I know we have a couple planned, but you know, do something in time for Halloween. And so we discussed a little bit of what we could talk about, and we talked about like other stuff that are, you know, worthy of being talked about. But
and I want to talk about the Babadook, and Taylor told me, Casey, you've brought up the Babadook on literally every episode since you
said it. My actual logic is
about the Babadook all the time. And
My actual logic is just that, you know, the Babadook's really recent. It's like, is it even a year old? I don't know.
It is a year. A year as of this week, because that's when I saw it in the film festival.
Okay, oh, so. Sure. And, you know, everyone within our friend group anyway has really seen it. Like, and on social media and stuff has seen it. And I want us to be more talking about like older stuff. So like we talked about The Haunting, which is very worthy of talking, you know, being talked about, but you also mentioned Silence of the Lambs. So, and since Silence of the Lambs is like this weird, like, I don't know how many people these days really look at it as like, that's a horror movie when it totally is.
Yeah. That is a horrorific movie.
Yeah.
But Taylor, there's no shrieking score or jump scares. If there are no jump scares, then how am I supposed to know when to be scared?
Yeah.
Sorry, that was really overly pedantic and like mocking at me, but that's how I feel. I'm sorry.
But anyway, so, and then of course, you know, just this last, you know, summer, the Hannibal TV series ended its 3-year run, and. It's okay, Neil.
Okay, who's being murdered on the other end?
That was
crazy. Oh, Liz was at the door, and I told her I'm recording. Can I wait? And now we're good.
Okay, cool. Just wondering.
But anyway, so yes, we are going to
talk about... Then I murdered her, so she wouldn't interrupt. No.
We're going to talk about what you can learn from Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal. So, Casey, take it away.
All right, so Silence of the Lambs is...
horrible... working sound like burr, burr.
That was me adjusting my ass.
Well, adjust your ass, god damn it.
You, Neil, there's barely an ass there. I need to make sure it's comfortable.
You say indeed. There's not a lot of ass there, but it's making a hell of a lot of noise.
Speaking of ass, it puts its lotion on its skin or else it gets nose again. Whatever, come on.
That is only vaguely tangentially related, Taylor.
I don't care. Talk. I gave Casey the fucking floor not to talk about his ass.
Anyways.
Silence of the Lambs is a horror movie, despite being released on Valentine's Day. And
come on, you have to admit, that's like the greatest bit of counter-marketing ever.
Yes, it is. It's the best movie ever to be released on Valentine's Day, including Valentine's Day.
We don't talk about Valentine's
Day. Or My Bloody Valentine.
neither that either.
But honestly, even though it was released at the beginning of the year, and even though it's a horror movie, this won Best Adapted Screenplay. And along with, you know, all the
other... a shit ton of other things.
Yeah. It won the 5 big awards. It won Best Picture.
Which
Best...
were...
What was that, Neil?
I said which were, and then like right as soon as I got like a quarter of the way through that, you actually started listing them off. So I botched that. I apologize.
Which were? Which were what, Casey?
All right. They were best director, best actor, best actress, and best picture. You know, and best screenplay, I guess. So,
and Anthony Hopkins was lead actor, right?
Yeah, he won lead actor, you know.
Which is weird, because he's only in it for, like, how many minutes?
18 minutes.
Yeah.
Is it really? I thought it was less for some reason.
No. My guess would have been 15, but I mean...
Like, yeah, yeah, 15 was mine.
He has 18 minutes of screen time, and he gets the nominee for best lead actor, to which Scott Glenn, I'm sure, is a little sad about to this day.
Thanks, Scott Glenn.
So... So that is why this is a perfect example of what you can learn from this. How can a horror movie based on, from what I can gather, Neil, I believe you've read the books, right?
I have read the book.
All right. So tell me if I'm wrong, but Silence of the Lambs has always seemed a bit pulpy to me.
They're incredibly pulpy. I mean, like, it's a lot like Ghostbusters in a sense, and I promise I'm going somewhere with this. Ghostbusters is this... completely like ridiculous fantasy concept wrapped around science, wrapped around the science of the subject at the time. It's a lot like Batman Begins, which, you know, is a movie about a guy dressed as a bat fighting crime. But the first half of the movie is basically laying down a whole bunch of science and facts to the point where basically you earn the audience's trust. You have them in your hand. You can do whatever the hell you want with it. And it's the same thing with Ghostbusters. I call it the Ghostbusters. I don't remember what but it's the Ghostbusters thing. I just botched that totally, which is start off as believably as you can, reinforce your facts with evidence. And then you will have the audience's trust and you can go completely off the wires and no one will care. Like, you'll still have them because you earned their trust.
And that's what I've always called that the Jurassic Park effect.
So, that's true. But Ghostbusters came like 10 years before. So,
but Jurassic Park is more obvious.
Shut up. So,
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think this is the problem you got. I think this is the episode above all else where I deserve to be shoved into a locker.
Yeah, probably. But anyway,
shut up, Casey. Let Neil talk in the segment that I gave Casey the floor.
Well, I opened up to Neil just because I knew he's read the Thomas Harris novels, and yeah. I admittedly have not, because I think reading's for suckers. So.
Don't be a loser. Don't read.
Casey's favorite thing is the Bible miniseries, because he was taught the Bible. He looked at the Bible and said, no thanks, I'll wait for the movie. And it did.
Actually, Neil?
What?
A few months ago, I was just talking with an old gentleman, and he asked, have you ever read the Bible? I read about 5.5 pages of it. I am so glad him and all the old people around him laughed, because otherwise I would just seem like a heretic.
I just skipped to the end. Everyone dies.
Except that one guy.
And
I totally thought he was dead for like 3/4 of the story, but he came back.
He was dead for like 3 days or something. I don't know.
That was a great twist ending there, Bible.
Damn it. Anyways, what I was going to say is that, the Thomas Harris novels, the first two, the third one is, we'll talk about that later.
What's the third one? What are they? What's the order?
Red Dragon, Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal.
Yeah.
So, and Hannibal Rising, which we don't talk about.
We don't talk about Hannibal Rising.
Hannibal, the TV series, basically lifted all of the worthwhile parts of Hannibal Rising. And they dedicated like maybe 2 or 3 episodes to that. And that's it. That's all you need to know. And that was the best thing about it.
Silence of the Lambs, as a movie, is a sequel, I guess, to a somewhat forgotten Michael Mann thriller from the 80s.
Manhunter, which they actually filmed partially in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Yeah, Manhunter is worth checking out, you know, I would say. Like, I know you're not a big fan of it, Neil, but I would say just give it a try and see what you like about it, because it's very 80s.
There are things that I like about it. I think that the cinematography is, you know, it's Dante Spinotti and Michael Mann, so, you know, it's right off the bat. It's gorgeous to look at. Yeah. But, like, it's so 80s that it basically shoots itself in the foot. Mm-hmm. And there are things that work in its favor, and then there are things where it just kind of completely drops the ball.
And Manhunter is an adaptation of Red Dragon, so...
It is, but the only reason... But they changed the title because they just thought that something with the title of Red Dragon wouldn't sell. Like, people would think it was a fantasy thing. It's like...
Well, in the middle of the 80s, I could see that.
Well, it's like William Friedberg's film Sorcerer, which happened to have the misfortune of coming out just before Star Wars. Sorcerer has actually nothing to do with fantasy, but they actually wanted to change the title because people were going to think, like, oh, people think it's like some, you know, Dungeons and Dragons highfalutin fantasy adventure. So it's sort of the same thing. They changed the title because they thought people are going to think this is like some fantasy thing. It's not going to sell. Anyways, sorry.
Red Dragon's weird because it actually has two pretty decent adaptations of it.
It does.
At this point, it has three.
If you count, I guess.
Which mainly Hannibal, right? Haven't seen the third season of Hannibal yet, so we might. For all I know, I'm going to hate that one. But
Hold on. I didn't. My point with the Hannibal books, though, is that. They are extremely pulpy. They are basically like, you know, pulp crime novels that are wrapped in like forensic, especially like psychology.
So like forensic stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, forensic stuff.
So it
masks itself around that to make you think that it isn't, but it is. But they're actually like extremely well told stories. So like even then, they're still better than the other things. It's just that. Sort of elevates it when at heart it still is the thing that it's trying to be better than.
Right. And the point I was getting to with all of that, which went on a little longer than I thought, is Silence of the Lambs is a sequel to a very dated 80s thriller based on a pulpy crime novel. Yep. And where they had to recast everybody, bring in a new director, new writer, new everybody. And does that sound like I'm summing up a Best Picture winner?
Yeah.
Nope.
It's a very unlikely Best Picture winner. Maybe the most unlikely in recent memory.
And yet, it did. And so what I'm talking about is, like, what can you learn from this in terms of how to tell a story? And what was that now?
Oh, no, it's just like, oh, man, yeah. I'm approaching this a little bit because I want to talk about I want to compare and contrast Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal, the series. I won't go on too long about that because I know this is Casey's child, and you know, I just. But
well, I wanted you on because I want to hear your thoughts, but I thought we would start with Silence of the Lambs because that's, you know, chronological.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I'm just...
And I've seen all of Silence of the Lambs, and I've only seen three episodes of Hannibal.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, like, I was just giving, like, a projection of, like, this is sort of where I want to head with it, but I won't go too much with it. But it's just something that you can look forward to hearing from me.
All right.
So, and
when I was watching Silence of the Lambs last night, as I do every night before I go to bed to give myself the pleasant dreams, I was thinking about, okay, why did this script resonate so well that they were able to get an Oscar? And it just gets down to, this is a horror movie, but it doesn't use as an excuse to just kill everybody off violently at the end. Or have, you know, a weird Nightmare on Elm Street-esque ending that was incredibly prominent, especially after Carrie decided every horror movie has to have a weird jump scare ending.
Thanks, yeah. Carrie. Wait, okay, which came first? Was it Carrie or Friday the 13th?
Carrie was 1976, and they were the ones that had the jump scare ending at the end where Carrie's arm jumped out of the ground.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember because Friday the 13th, the original, did this kind of the same thing,
yeah.
And I hated that too. it's just such a nonsensical jump scare ending.
I mean, it makes sense with Carrie because that one's told in a dream. My issue with the Carrie one is Carrie, even though she's a horror movie villain, there's an emotional impact to Carrie. You feel so sorry for Sissy Spacek that entire movie. And ending it on such a boo, scared you, two for flinching ending pisses me off.
Yeah, and, I can't say I disagree at all.
And Silence of the Lambs, I mean, that's another thing, I'll get to that in there, but Silence of the Lambs also has a ending that does kind of something like that, but it still ties up its story, it still actually gives you know, another big thing that more horror movies need. The character has an arc. This movie...
What? Characters have arcs? That's stupid.
And the arc isn't just this person solves this or this person doesn't die. Clarice Starling, you can chart this movie through what she's doing as a character, how she grows more confident, how she grows less confident. And that's another thing. This is Clarice Starling's story. This is how she goes from an underappreciated FBI Academy member to top of her class graduate. I think that's where she was at the end of it.
Yeah. Something like that. I would hope so.
I mean, she did.
She graduated like the top 10, whatever, but there was this other girl
Ted Levine.
There's this other girl that completely solved the fucking Kennedy assassination. She got first class. Yeah.
I mean, it was a tough year. And the Salutarian found the Zodiac Killer, so.
I have this feeling that if they remade Silence of the Lambs nowadays, it would just be that Clarice Starling is just too awesome, and that society, all of her classmates' problems is that they don't realize just how awesome she is. She has no arc. It's just a matter about them finally realizing how awesome Clarice Starling is.
I think Jodie Foster just got the award just for saying Dr. Lecter so many times at the end.
And of course there'd be some foretold prophecy that the Starling is going to bring down the buffalo or something.
Yeah.
The chosen one.
Yeah, there's like some ancient tribe and fucking...
And Neil, you're joking, but to a degree there is that in there, but that's another point I wanted to bring up about the screenplay. You get told, especially in the first act, so much of the exposition isn't done through dialogue. How do you... the first time you see Clarice Starling, you see her running away through the woods during the opening credits, and you know you're in a horror movie, so you're like, okay, is she running away from somebody? Is she chasing somebody? And then the next time... And then you find out her name because somebody says Starling and approaches her. He sends her off somewhere, and the guy turns around and he's wearing an FBI hat. So it's like, okay, yeah. So she's for the FBI. Next time you see, when she's going to Jack Crawford's office, she passes a friend very briefly. It's only one shot. They high five. And now that friend, I can't even remember her name. She's such a minor character, but she's a confidant, which for a movie that's about a mystery, you need that so she can exposit the stuff that she's solving.
You mean, you talk about all this, Casey, as if it is a competently written screenplay.
I think too is, like, you know, what you're talking about lends itself a lot from the cinematography, you know, the whole thing. It's like, this is probably one of the best recent examples of Shoto for a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, but just how they make the viewer really sympathize with Clarice through cinematography.
It's
like when you first see, you know, when we're first introduced to Dr. Hannibal Lecter, when he's in the prison and he's in his cell, you know, you have this very, like, you're basically seeing Hannibal through her eyes. So you get this, like, solid, just, he's in the center of the frame as close as fucking possible. And you just, you know, grow so uncomfortable to him, and it makes you super tense.
Well, I also noticed this, 90% of the conversations in this are shot, reverse shot, POV. Like, when you're looking at Jack Crawford, you'll never see Clarice Starling in the shot. And when you're looking at Clarice Starling, you'll never see Jack Crawford. Mm-hmm. And just another thing that helps make the movie feel really, really very uncomfortable. Comfortably uncomfortable, I'd almost say.
Well, it's also, like, a lot of the scenes are supposed to be, like, you know, they're the character, you're supposed to be in Clarice Starling's shoes, where the character that she's talking to is looking directly into the camera, you know, addressing the camera. You're supposed to be Clarice, which makes it uncomfortable, which is it was kind of revolutionary at the time. Jonathan Demme was, you know, I don't know too much about what he does nowadays, but, you know, he was a really radical filmmaker in kind of like a really subtle way. And that was a technique that he would later go on to use a whole lot. Especially in his next film, which is actually one of my favorites, Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. He did with Philadelphia.
It's with Tom Hanks, you know? He did Philadelphia. It's a great movie.
Actually, Neil, want to know what his next project is according to IMDb?
What is his next
Untitled project? Justin Timberlake concert film.
He's done concert films before.
Yeah, he does concert films. He does documentaries. He's done a lot of documentaries.
What was his last project?
Ricky and the Flash.
Yeah, Ricky and the Flash. He did a couple episodes of The Killing.
Okay. Oh, God, did he? He's so above that. The Killing is basically aping his style from Silence of the Lambs.
It's cyclical. It's like poetry. It rhymes.
Oh, that's terrible. Shut up, George Lucas.
He just became the more sophisticated Chris Columbus. And going back to the writing of Silence of the Lambs, another thing I wanted to bring up was a character who I'm convinced any other movie would have botched completely. Dr. Chilton. Now, Dr. Chilton is, you know, kind of a complete asshole. But he's not just an asshole for sake of being an asshole. He's not just there to be another antagonist that Clarice has to overcome. You actually buy why he's doing what he's doing. Like, he actually tries to be friendly with the FBI. The FBI didn't want him involved because, you know, fuck that guy. And from there on out, all the decisions he makes, which makes things so much worse, you can see why he's doing it. He's being overlooked, and he doesn't want to be overlooked anymore.
Yeah.
And so they found the right middle ground to make him kind of a scumbag, but a way that you totally believe it. So you're...
He's not just a black and white villain?
I said, you mean he's not just a black and white villain?
Oh my god.
It's almost like he's a nuanced character with different shades of gray? Fuck.
Well, it's like, if they just made him a villain, it's like you already have three fucking villains in this movie
at that point. Spider-Man 3?
No, Jesus Christ. We need Venom, damn it. Venom comes in the Silence of the Lambs.
It turns out Buffalo Bill was a pawn this whole time. The real enemy was communism. I don't know. I don't know.
That explains the communist message. Use every part of the buffalo.
Oh, shut up. God damn it. Anyways.
God damn it. God damn it.
Motherfucker.
And one pro Jared dicks. Dicks.
Yep.
Dicks.
Yeah. So
So is there anything else you want to say about Silence of the Lambs, Casey? Or you wanna lead into Hannibal?
There are a few more notes I was gonna bring up storytelling wise. And again, I know these all seem like minor things. This seems like I'm just going like, and here's some things Silence of the Lambs does right. What I'm trying to say is this is stuff that isn't always done, especially in horror movies. And I'm saying, and the horror movies just relies on its genre as an excuse for poor quality. It's like, no, a horror movie can win Best Picture.
Well, it's like romantic comedies. I mean, you know, romantic comedies as a genre is very, you know, kind of despised as a whole. But it's like you think about stuff like Eternal Sunshine or Her, and it's like this is like it can work. You can defy the tropes of your genre and create great movies.
I would wholeheartedly endorse Her in the same regard of it's a rom-com, but that's no, and it follows most of the staples of a rom-com. It just happens to be one of them's a computer, but
and it hits the same beats, it hits the same tropes, but how it gets there is ingenious.
Yeah.
Like it's not exactly what you do, it's how you do it. It's not exactly mm-hmm. what you do in your script or like what beats you hit, it's how you approach those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can be creatively uncreative, I would say.
Yeah. You can be unpredictably predictable.
Yeah.
Well, and Her is very much a high concept movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that Silence of the Lambs is a perfect screenplay for that matter. I think there's flaws with it. I find it weird that the first time you see Buffalo Bill, they're going out of their way to hide his face, and then the second time it's like, oh, and there's his face. Like, there's weird stuff like that. There's a few scenes that I think have a little bit too much dialogue in there, or they're hitting the same beats more than once, like having those cops spend a minute talking about how, God, Hannibal wanted a second dinner. Such a pig. Blah, 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 blah.
Like, yeah, that part always struck me as a little clunky. But on the other hand, like...
But it leads into that horrifying scene.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so can we talk about the scene where Hannibal escapes prison as basically this really amazing short film within
basically.
That's a short film right there, and it happens at, like, the beginning of the third act. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So there's
go on, Neil.
I don't know. I guess I didn't really have that much to say about it aside from
Besides, it's awesome.
It's amazing. One of the things that I really praise this movie for is, if you ever notice, there's not actually a whole lot of violence that occurs on screen.
Well, there's not a lot of big body count.
Yeah, there's really not a big body count either.
Like two or three? I don't know.
It's just,
I think there's one person dies on screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of looking at corpses.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's one of those movies that's sort of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre that kind of like everything that people accuse it of being, it's not. Mm-hmm. Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, people are like, oh yeah, it's like the bloodiest film ever made. No, there's actually almost no violence that happens on screen. All of it is implied, or all of it happens behind.
As far as like gore and stuff, but it's probably the brutalest part of that movie, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is when, you know, that one guy walks in and the like metal sheet door opens and he gets hit on the head.
But it's like,
and there's the part where the guy in the wheelchair gets cut up.
Well, yeah, that too.
But nobody's like sad about that.
But like the sheet door hammer to the head thing, it's like, it's just like a lot of it is the other things around it. Like the fact that there's no music.
Music, but it's not necessarily music, but it's soundscapes.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like there's Foley and just the sound of it. It's like, you don't need blood to tell you, oh, this is fucking terrifying. And,
yeah, like the camera work and the soundscapes are all you need to know that this is.
And it's shot very matter-of-factly in a way. Like,
well, there's this weird thing. Like, there are some scenes that are, it's shot, you know, very matter-of-factly. It's very, like, kind of rough and dirty. But then there are also some, like, really striking cinematic shots in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of come out of nowhere, which is
That's kind of like how Silence of the Lambs is, to bring it back around. You know, like when you first watch it, it might not strike you like oh man, this is amazing cinematography, except for the stuff we're talking about that are, you know, just storytelling tools. It's very subconscious stuff that gets into your head. I mean, there's obviously there are some really great cinematic, you know, shots, like the guy being strung up on the cage, and that the whole scene that we were talking about with Neil, like the whole prison break sequence, the fact that like they're able to tell you all this little information, like all the stuff that's in Hannibal's cell really quick and how he breaks out and it's never confusing is really great. So
also the fact that there's very little dialogue throughout that prison break.
Mm-hmm.
You ever notice that there's like
there's very little dialogue. There's a lot of shots that cut back to that one guy who keeps going to the corner or pointing his gun up. That guy really wants to check his corner.
Check your corners.
Maybe he's a decent cop, or he's just really overeager. You never know. Character building. Fuck everything.
No, well, that's another thing I wanted to talk about with it is the tertiary characters in Silence of the Lambs are not stock characters. Like, think about when the first clue Clarice Starling gets is to go over to a storage facility. And so what you need is somebody there to say, oh, this storage locker's been here for like 10 years, yada, yada, yada. And they get an old European immigrant and his. Those are interesting people. You kind of want to know more about them. They're not very important, but it brings a little bit of texture in there.
But there's actual effort put into making them at least interesting. Yeah,
they're memorable. You know? They're not.
Yeah, they're not just like spewing exposition and whatever.
Yeah, they're not driver number one and guy who owns storage facility number one. And
not that those are bad names, but you know, I mean, if that's your name.
I mean, I have named several children guy who owns storage facility number one,
driver number one.
One of them's an assistant manager at a Walgreens.
Apologize to all the driver number ones out there.
Apologize.
Or on the other side, the two guys who tell Clarice about the moth are dweebish, a little weird, and work at a museum, but hey, they're memorable.
Yeah, exactly. They're not just stock characters.
Yeah.
Which seems to be such a problem nowadays. With just, I'm just here to deliver exposition. That's great. Who are you? I don't care.
Or they make them, like, too wacky and out there, so they just kind of clash with the whole vibe.
Well, no, they're Johnny Depp.
They fit the tone of the movie.
Yeah.
While still actually, they contribute to the tone, and it doesn't feel forced at all. And I don't know, it's, you know, basic things that you that some people forget when they're making a movie.
Yeah. I was having this conversation with my dad at dinner, because he and I talk about things, believe it or not. We're a fan of talking. Oh, that actually was sad. So sorry, Casey, even though I didn't do that, you did that. He and I were talking about movies. He had just seen Martian, and this is actually the first thing my dad has seen in theaters for a while, and it's also the first
thing he's seen.
A Martian with Matt Damon.
Oh, the Martian, okay. It keeps, like, skipping. So it's like, oh, Martian, and it's like, what?
I honestly thought you were saying Repulsion. I was like, Ingmar Bergman?
That's an old
movie. Is that the last time your dad went to a movie theater?
Yeah. Survive so the Titanic.
The Martian.
He saw The Martian, and he was talking about, you know, the screenplay. You know, it's like, actually, it's well written. I was like, yeah, it's Drew Goddard. Drew Goddard's pretty awesome. But I was telling him that I've kind of calmed down. Like, I hate when people are like, oh, what happened there? Like, well, why don't you just wait 5 minutes and they'll explain it to you? Like, Godzilla, just calm down for a second. Like, can you just not? Are you just not patient? And like that drives me up a wall, obviously. But I've calmed down about it over the past couple of years because I realize that it's not necessarily people's impatience. It's just that there's so much shitty writing out there now that there are things that aren't explained that should be explained. And I think that people are just afraid that it's not going to be explained. Like, did I just miss something? And it's like, no, you didn't miss it. It wasn't established. Nothing was done with it. It just came out of nowhere. It's like you could tell them, no, it's just a bad script. It's not you, I promise. Like, I was watching the fifth Die Hard movie, and there's a scene where John McClane and his idiot son are like, it's like towards the end of the movie, and they're finally captured by the bad guys, and they've got like ropes tied behind their hands or whatever the fuck. And they're all laughing and like clearly trying to divert or something, like to cause a diversion. And the son, it cuts back to the son has a knife and he's cutting the rope. It's like, okay, when was that knife ever established? Like, you'd never established that at all. That just comes out of nowhere. And also, it really does a disservice to the tension of the film. It's like, oh, well, whatever. No matter what they get into, there's always going to be Machina to come in. And
so why were you watching A Good Day to Die Hard?
I don't know.
He thought he was watching A Hard Day's Night and got confused.
A Good Day to A Hard Day's Night Hard.
Because when I kill you alone, bitch, you'll be so alone.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. The end.
So, anyways, but like, that's... I've calmed down about that. And that's something that, like, I know that the scripts of James Cameron always go out of their way to do, is to establish things later on. Silence of the Lambs does the same thing.
Chekhov's gun, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that we, and I know you and I have talked about this, Neil, but writing isn't necessarily the easiest part of a storytelling process in film, but it's the easiest one to fix.
But it's the easiest one to fix, and it's also the cheapest one.
Yeah, it's the cheapest one to fix, and it's the cheapest one to, and it's the one where it's you're able to find the most people who can collaborate in order to find a way to make it work.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's like, you know, with a good script, you can forego something that you can spend like $30 million just to do one scene, but it's like with a good script, you can easily cut that down to just like a few lines of dialogue, or like how you can imply that. And be creative with your filmmaking. It's just, there's no excuse after a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and granted, obviously, it's such a collaborative medium that a lot of times, like, you don't just have... It's why it's so hard to talk about the greatest screenplays of all time, because unless you're somebody like Alfred Hitchcock, who his main goal is, this script, no one touched it, I'm going to translate exactly what this script is.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the script as interpreted through the director, the cinematographer, the producers, and the editors.
Yeah.
But still, the idea is just, you have to make sure...
It's a good foundation.
Yeah, it's a good foundation, And if it's told well enough and make sure people are on the same page, then you can still do something really great. And I think Silence of the Lambs is a great example of it, where you have, and it's like we said, it's a movie that won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Lead Actor, Best Lead Actress. I think if it didn't win, it was at least nominated for cinematography and editing. The only
cinematography is by a guy named Tak Fujimoto.
Mm-hmm.
You guys should look his stuff up. He is one of my favorites. I think the most recent thing I can think of that he did was, he did something recently and I was like, oh, who did this? Oh, it was Tak Fujimoto. Well, of course it was great. But I know that he worked on the John Adams miniseries, like the first few episodes he worked on those, and those are gorgeous to look at.
But did he win for Silence of the Lambs, or did that, cause it was either that or JFK that won. I can't remember which.
I don't know. And of course that one you're up against Robert Richardson for cinematography with JFK, and it's like, fuck, how do you choose? Robert Richardson's a lot more showy. Tak Fujimoto is much more naturalistic.
Yeah. Which is kind of the same thing with Silence of the Lambs and JFK. One of them is naturalistic, one of them is very flashy.
One of them is naturalistic, the other one is JFK. Not wrong. Yeah, so, I mean, like, is
okay,
that...
Okay, what the fuck? Cinematography was not nominated. Never mind, I'm completely wrong.
This whole thing's a bust. Abort.
I am sorry what you could learn from. You were never meant to see the light of day.
I'm gonna throw Tak Fujimoto under the bus. You disappointed me for the last time, Tak.
The world wasn't ready for your greatness.
So we have to change it. Silence of the Lambs now sucks. 1.5 out of 5 stars. Would recommend.
Rising. It sucks 3.5 out of 5.
More like Hannibal Falling.
Oh, fuck off. Anyways, so is that all you wanted to say for Silence of the Lambs for the most part? Because I was gonna delve into Hannibal for a brief moment, if that's cool.
Well, I know Casey wanted to talk about Hannibal as like a reboot adaptation kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's fine too. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, the thing with the only other note I had was I really like the edit where Starling says, what exactly is Hannibal Lecter? And it just cuts to Chilton saying, oh, he's a monster.
Oh, yeah, the editing is great. Like, just
yeah, which is honestly, even though that sounds like just a joke note, that is a good note, because the moment there's nothing more to say in that scene, you cut right to the next scene, which gives you more information that you need.
It's almost like the editing was responsible.
But... Well, it's like, another adjective I'd use on the movie Silence of the Lambs is that it's a very efficient movie.
Yeah. Yes. That was actually something I was thinking about bringing
it's
up.
It's very efficient. Yeah. It's very efficient. It's a
editing. Efficient movie.
There's no wasted frames of anything. There's no wasted dialogue, really. I mean, obviously Casey pointed out some...
Yeah, there's few superfluous parts, but very, very, very tiny.
Yes, but it's like when you look at it as one big picture, then it's like, oh man, like this is just a really efficient film that just uses all of its time. There's very little wasted in it.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
So anyways.
So Hannibal.
Hannibal, the 2001 Ridley Scott movie.
Yes.
Okay, actually, in defense of the Hannibal, talking about the books, the story behind the books is that Thomas Harris doesn't really write. He just writes Hannibal properties. And this was after the success of Silence of the Lambs, the runaway success of Silence of the Lambs, and the Dino De Laurentiis company said, listen, we want to keep on this money train and ride this cocaine-fueled train to success. So you're going to give us another Hannibal Lecter book. And Harris is like, well, I mean, I don't really have anything to do with that right now. I mean, I just don't have anything. And then they like slammed their fists down and were like, give me what I want. And they started crying and kicking their feet. And so Thomas Harris says, okay, fine, whatever. Just, you know, get out of my house and stop peeing on my carpet. And
leave me alone.
Yeah.
You've made it sound like you've made Dino De Laurentiis and Thomas Harris sound like a Pink Floyd song.
Well, maybe they are. Have you heard about things like stories about Dino De Laurentiis in the 70s? They're pretty great.
Seen the King Kong remake, Neil.
God, where they're like, hey, Harris, make another book.
And I was thinking have a cigar, but that's even better.
I wish I had thought of that. I'm mad now. Anyways, so Thomas Harris was like, all right, you know what? You want this book? Well, fine. I'm going to make this the most cocaine-fueled, hallucinogenic, stupid thing ever written to paper, and I'll see you film this over my cold, dead body. So naturally, they sanctioned the rights, and they filmed it. But there is so much batshit insanity in that book that the only way that it could possibly make sense was if Harris was like, they'll never film this. And then they did.
Man, if they ate Ray Liotta's, well, not whatever Ray Liotta's character's name is, they just, and then Hannibal eats his brain. feeds him his brain.
And that is now the second best property to be named Hannibal.
So that's how I think
solidifying Thomas Harris, that it will be forgotten forever.
Yep.
I don't know if Hannibal's ever going to be forgotten just because of how fucking ridiculous it is.
It is. But on the other hand,
who worked on it? I mean, you got Hopkins, you got Gary Oldman, it's fucking Ridley Scott.
Yeah, it's Ridley Scott. Well, I mean, Ridley Scott is not immune from bad filmmaking.
Well, I know. I'm just saying in terms of notoriety. Oh, it's not necessarily quality.
You've got Steve Zaillian, the guy who wrote the screenplay. He wrote the script for Schindler's List.
Yeah, you got a good screenwriter.
Yeah, to be fair, like, it's Steve Zaillian really was just kind of doing what he could. There's a lot of things that he left out of the book that I'm like, thank God.
Yeah, and like Steve Zaillian reading the book is like that shot of Troy in Community when he walks into the apartment when everything's on fire.
That is exactly what
happened. Or that meme of that dog sitting in a burning house. This is fine.
Steve Zaillian actually did lose his larynx when he tried to swallow the book to avoid having to write an adaptation of it.
Yeah, like that's the only thing I could imagine happened with Steve Zaillian, and he was just like, there's no fucking way.
Alright, so enough about Hannibal. Let's talk about Hannibal.
Okay. I was just gonna say, like, I'll always kind of forgive the movie because John Matheson, the cinematographer, did an extraordinary job. I would say it's one of Hans Zimmer's best scores. And it's just generally like something that's okay to have in the background. So it could be a lot worse. It's mostly just fucking weird.
It could be Hannibal Rising.
Yeah, that was what I was about to say.
I think we were all thinking it. Taylor just said it. It could have been Hannibal Rising. Anyways, Hannibal the series, go on ahead.
Mackadish Mackady do.
So, Hannibal the series doesn't suck. Say that about literally any other reboot series of the past few years.
Oh no, man. Minority Report could turn it around. I don't know.
I actually haven't seen Minority Report, so we're on.
I haven't either.
Actually, Taylor, that's not a reboot series. It's a sequel series. They brought back some original actors.
Yeah.
I'm happy about it. Doesn't need to happen.
Ugh.
How many reboot series are there, though? Like, that's a good question.
I mean, there was the Rosemary's Baby miniseries.
Which is best forgotten.
But are those, like, just readaptations? When I was watching Hannibal, I was like, this isn't so much like a weird reboot. It's just like, let's just adapt the books again.
That is what I wanted to get into. Someone tell me I'm completely wrong if you feel like I'm completely wrong. But are there really enough Thomas Harris fans to say we need to adapt his property again? No, the reason they're adapting Hannibal is because people remember the name Hannibal because they remember Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, and the book was really popular. I mean,
it was.
Yeah, the book was popular, but the movie was a runaway success again.
I'm not saying that, but
the books were all like huge blockbusters. You know, they were huge bestsellers. Hannibal Rising was a bestseller.
Like, I mean, why would they make fucking Hannibal Rising? Which, I mean, that was what, 6 years after the last movie. I mean, there's a reason why. Like, it took, like, they still made Hannibal the movie. Which, that should be the new name. Hannibal, colon, the movie.
Yeah.
But it's
Hannibal.
Like...
Can't wait
like...
for Hannibal the musical.
But it's just... No, there's already Cannibal the musical, so, you know.
Neil, are you telling me you would not watch a musical that includes the lyrics, I ate his liver with some fava beans, with some fava beans, with some fava beans, and a nice Chianti?
Because that would be Silence of the Lambs, a musical, and not Hannibal, a musical.
I just keep thinking of, let's build a snowman. We can name him Bob, or we can name him Beowulf. Snowman! So anyway.
All right. Hannibal. So Hannibal. So Hannibal.
Hannibal is... I guess I'm wrong then in my theory that Hannibal is trying to recapture the popularity that you would find in the Silence of the Lambs movie series then.
I think that's what initially it started as. Like, it was just going to be procedural, that's like a prequel to the prequel, you know, with Red Dragon. And then Brian Fuller got involved, and I think
the genesis of the idea, the people who had the money behind it, who said we could turn a profit with this, their idea was that, which is the same logic that went into Bates Motel, or Rosemary's Baby, or Minority Report,
or Carrie.
Or A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, we're talking about, like, all the shitty remakes now and Halloween. Fucking garbage. So anyway, there was, you remember that tweet I did, Neil, about that? Where I was like, it's been 7 years, or 8 years since the Rob Zombie Halloween remake, and it still sucks all kinds of ass.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, did you see my response to it, which is about the,
The Total Recall
about
movie?
For a movie called Total Recall, I cannot tell you a goddamn thing.
I can't recall any of it!
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Red Letter Media guys are bringing up a really interesting point about, like, the Friday the 13th remake and the Nightmare on Elm Street remake and the Halloween remake, which is that, like, nobody talks about the first two, but everyone talks about the Halloween remake, despite the fact that everyone talks about how shitty it is and the other ones are just like, you know, whatever, it's not good. Whereas, like, Rob Zombie's is, like, offensively shitty.
Well, it's just that it's, like, you know, and I was talking to Casey earlier about the Nightmare on Elm Street one and how it kind of misses the point. But Rob Zombie's just completely misses the fucking point.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Rob Zombie's decided to make a character that you absolutely hate, your protagonist.
Well, yeah, and then you go into the sequel, which is just so fucking batshit.
Yeah.
Love hurts, like, Neil. Love hurts.
Like,
love stars.
Like, if you held up a dark mirror of an alternate universe to Clarice Starling, you would get the remake.
Scout Taylor Compton or whatever her fucking name is.
Yeah, you'd get remake Laurie Stroud. Which, by the way, Neil, I've now seen exactly 30 seconds of the Nightmare on Elm Street remake. They're the last 30 seconds, and I'm not sure why, as a species, we keep trying to achieve perfection. We've already done that.
Yeah, because I told them how shitty the remake ends. Like, the Red Letter Media thing, you know, they talk about how funny it is with the blow-up doll being pulled through the window. And then you have the remake where it's like Nancy's mom is in front of a mirror and fucking Freddy Krueger, like, stabs her through the fucking face, like the back of the head. And
so it's, like, much CG blood flying everywhere.
And it's such a stupid, whoa, 3D shot. God. And then she gets pulled into, like, whatever, like, Satan's toilet swirling in the fucking mirror, and that's the end. And it's like, and I was telling Casey, like, I can't believe that it's fucking Rooney Mara in this movie.
Well, Rooney Mara, I know that she had some choice words for that remake.
Because I'm sure, it's like, I almost made me wonder, like, on the set of The Social Network, David Fincher was just like, oh, you got this thing on the back of your neck, and it's like a switch to, like, turn on, like, and off her acting.
Yeah.
It switched to bad acting. Let's switch it to good acting. Hey, I mean, you want to be my remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
I mean, she looked like she was the best thing in that movie, and it kind of was, like, I know that she talked about, like, just having nothing to do.
Oh, that's fucking sad, because she looks fucking awful in that. She's fucking awful in the movie.
Yeah.
She's just, like, bored and dull. It's like...
She was just like, there's nothing to do. Like, I don't have a character. There's nothing going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, like, rather than build on that, she was still relatively new as well.
Oh, yeah, it was before The Social Network, so.
One of my favorite things about Rooney Mara, aside from the fact that I find her very attractive, is how very blunt she is about projects that she was not happy about. Like, I know that she's talked about being on Law & Order.
So she's gonna say about how Pan sucked ass and why she was cast when she's white?
There's a lot. I thought that the only thing that would be really redeeming about that would be the Dario Marianelli soundtrack, because it's a Joe Wright movie, and he almost always works with Dario Marianelli, and those guys are like the Spielberg John Williams duo.
And I was like, oh no.
Well, then Joe it turns Wright. Out that,
oh
well,
no.
Well, it turns out that John Powell wrote the score instead, and I'm like, oh, John Powell.
Oh, now you have no redeeming qualities, Pan. Get the fuck out of here.
Well, I like John Powell just fine, but he's not Dario Marianelli working with Joe Wright. I think Dario Marianelli was working on a couple other things, so he couldn't work on that. Like, he did Everest thing.
Yeah, in conclusion, Pan sucks. Don't see it.
Have you seen it? Because I...
No, I've seen lots of reviews and clips, and I'm like, ugh, no.
Every trailer just makes me want to die.
The fact that you just told me Joe Wright directed Pan made me really sad.
I know, right? It's like, you made fucking Atonement.
I thought the saddest thing Joe Wright would ever do would be the ending of Atonement. Turns out, I was wrong.
Apparently, like, Joe Wright's direction is not exactly the problem. Like, apparently, like, he's doing everything he can to make this worthwhile, like, just to make it, like, a really batshit insane experience. It's just that the script, no matter what you do, just sucks. And the and the premise of it is just horribly misguided and wrong. And I don't know how this thing won an award at the Blacklist, at the Blacklist script competition, whatever. Like, because it's clearly shit. I don't get it. I don't know what happened.
The world is filled with madness, and you find yourself rooting for a man who eats people.
Yes. Hannibal. Anyway, back to Hannibal. So did you guys miss anything while I was gone?
Well,
nope.
Well, what we were talking about with the Rob Zombie Halloween remake, and with especially Bates Motel, which I think I've mentioned before on the podcast. I'm not really a fan of it. It's not my cup of tea.
Whatever. Teach their own.
I watched.
Only compared it to the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand maybe once a week for the last 3 years.
That's an improvement, believe me. You see, like, every day. Every goddamn.
To lie to me. It's like, sorry, guys, I'm watching Archduke Ferdinand get assassinated for an hour again. # Bates Motel.
Yeah, no, I've only seen, like, a couple episodes of Bates Motel, and I was not impressed. I mean, like, here's the thing. Vera Farmiga is always giving her A game in everything she's in, and she is incredible. And Freddie Highmore, the kid who's playing
Norman Bates.
Bates, he's not bad at all. But it's just like, why is this happening? Why does this exist? Like,
the writing's bad. It's exploitative. Yeah. It's just there to remind you that the show Psycho is a thing that you can buy on DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah,
and it's based on nostalgia. Like, that is the big issue. That is the big issue with that. And nostalgia at points can even be deterred against it, not just in terms of, oh my god, stop being nostalgic already, but it doesn't really make sense. Like, I'm always going to go back to, in the pilot episode, you have all the original sets. In fact, they even make the interior sets look like the original sets from Psycho. So it's like, okay, this looks like dying old Americana that you would get in the 60s and then later on again in the 80s. But it's 2013, I believe, when that one takes place. So it doesn't really look right when you see modern-day Freddie Highmore fiddling with an iPhone against this 1950s kitchen background.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a clearly misguided attempt made by people who aren't quite sure what they're doing. Bates Motel can eat a dick. I don't know.
But anyway, Hannibal. The polar opposite of Bates Motel.
Well, Hannibal works so well because, one, you're covering a basis in the books that's alluded to, but it's never really talked about. Like,
well, I also like how in Hannibal, and I've only seen the first three episodes, but I think that it's a decent base for, like, an episodic procedural type of show.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know what you'd fucking do with Bates Motel to make a fucking series out of it.
Apparently in the season one finale, Norman Bates goes to prom.
Well, it's like, who the fuck cares? Oh, nice. Why are you making a show about this? You know,
exactly,
it's
like, who the fuck cares?
But it's like, with Hannibal, it's like, okay, you basically make a police procedural with Hannibal Lecter as a character. You know, you take the basis of most of the movies, which is about Hannibal Lecter is this, guy who helps solve murders for psychopaths, and you basically just make a fucking show about it.
Yeah, and the thing is, even if you didn't know anything about Silence of the Lambs, you could still really enjoy Hannibal, because honestly, if you watch the first episode, you would almost wonder, why is this called Hannibal for a little while? Hannibal doesn't show up until halfway through.
Yeah, through the first episode, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Then again, you'd miss out on, like, the amazing dramatic irony that the viewers have with everything. Where it's like, oh, I know stuff that Will doesn't know.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not dependent on that. You could watch it either way, and it would still be great.
It is arguably better if you don't know anything, but that's just so hard, you know, to not know about Hannibal Lecter.
Well, but later on in the series, they start playing around with stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which, admittedly, maybe wasn't my favorite part of the series, but it's not enough to make me go, like, ew. It's just like, okay, whatever.
But it's cool that they're willing to, like, play around with the, as I mentioned, the dramatic irony that, like knowing that the viewers know about who Hannibal Lecter actually is, and actually playing around with it and addressing it, as opposed to, like, you know, just ignoring it or whatever.
Yeah.
Or
but it's
playing
not...
it up too much.
But Hannibal relies so little on nostalgia, there's points where I would downright say it was kind of jarring when it plays on it. There was, like, there's a scene, I believe it's in season 2, where Hannibal Lecter is in bed with a woman, and they're waking up, and someone knocks on the door, and he goes, oh, the last time someone knocked on my door this early, it was a census taker.
Yes.
And honestly, exactly. That line actually kind of, even though it's objectively a just fine line, it threw me off because I'm so not used to this series trying to rely on Silence of the Lambs imagery.
Oh, wait till you get to season 3. They do the whole plot. Especially the Red Dragon arc. No, it's not too bad. It's actually kind of like, oh, I see what you're doing here. That's cool. It's not bad.
As long as it doesn't end with somebody going, Dr. Lecter, we have somebody for you. Her name's Miss Starling.
Dr. Lecter.
You'd like her. She's cute.
You'll like her. She's your taste.
Dr. Lecter.
That's like the one thing I really don't like about Red Dragon, aside from the fact that it's directed by Brett fucking Ratner.
Hey, but when that fucker can direct a decent movie, he directs a decent movie.
Yeah, he directs a decent movie. Here's the thing with Red Dragon. You have Ted Talley, the same screenwriter as Silence of the Lambs, coming back for Red Dragon, except under a tighter studio scrutiny because they want to make money as opposed to, let's just adapt this book. You have Anthony Hopkins, who's now there for way longer than he rightfully should be, but it's still delightful to see him. You have Dante Spinotti, the same cinematographer who shot Manhunter. You have Danny Elfman doing the score, and you have like this great cast, who just kind of sleepwalks through the entire... Edward Norton doesn't even phone it in for Red Dragon. He, like, texts it in.
Unlike Hugh Dancy, which kind of, for me, honestly, he steals the show watching Hannibal.
Dancy is the best representation of Will Graham because he made him, like, autistic and socially awkward, which is, like, that's how he would go about doing this in the books, as opposed to just, oh, I've just got anger issues, you know, William Peterson from Manhunter, or Edward Norton, who is comatose the entire time. He is. I love Edward Norton, but Red Dragon is not his crowning moment.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, I mean, with Hannibal, the way Hannibal is, so much of it hinges on, you know, the performance of Will Graham.
Yeah, exactly.
Hugh Dancy, I just like his name. Hugh Dancy. What has Hugh Dancy done?
Dancy.
He's done a lot of romantic comedies.
Really? Oh my god, yes.
He's done
so. He's like Andrew Lincoln or whatever from... Because that's the name of the guy from who plays Rick in Walking Dead, right?
Yeah.
It's like he was doing just fucking romantic comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
He was also... Oh my god, he was in Confessions of a Shopaholic.
Yes, he was.
Hugh Dancy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Little Dancy Man.
Saving Grace, the Jane Austen Book Club.
I want Ted Danson and Hugh Dancy to, like, do dances together.
Basic Instinct 2.
Oh my god, he was in Basic Instinct 2? That's a shame.
Yeah. Basic Instinct 2, he played Adam Towers.
Oh, yeah, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about anything.
First of all, Basic Instinct 2. we don't fucking talk about Basic Instinct too.
So if I can make my case for Hannibal for just a moment, because this is what I had, this is sort of why I wanted to talk about it, like comparing and contrasting Hannibal and Silence of the Lambs. One of the things that I find fascinating about it, my last girlfriend, way back in the day, she watched Silence of the Lambs without me, and I was really upset because, one, I didn't know that she hadn't seen it before, and two, I wanted to watch it with her. Like, what the fuck? But she loved it. She thought it was amazing. So, like, I got to, like, live texting her about it while she was watching it towards the end. And, you know, her reactions to it are great. I loved her reactions to things, especially Gone Girl. That was a good one. But anyways, oh, her reaction to Gone Girl was great. It was like, what the fuck did I just watch? Like, yeah, I know. It's amazing, right?
Yeah, I know, right?
But she thought it was great. And I told her, like, I cannot wait to show you Hannibal because, and here's my thesis statement. Hannibal and Silence of the Lambs both achieved the same things. They both achieved the same goals through radically different means.
Yeah. Because and that is where this succeeds when Bates Motel fails in every possible way.
Motel is basically the whole time is like, hey, remember Psycho? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You remember that?
Remember movie? Psycho? Here's the characters going to prom.
Yeah, exactly. And Hannibal is like, listen, we're going to do something completely different. And yeah. Hannibal, you can see its influence in so many things now, which is a shame that it got fucking canceled. But Hannibal, like, Silence of the Lambs, like, style-wise, it's a lot like a Law & Order episode, except I shouldn't say that because that's an insult to Hannibal. That's an insult to Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs is so strikingly well shot. It's masterfully composed. But, it's cinematic,
but it's understated.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
A cinematic shot in Silence of the Lambs would be how you establish Clarice Starling is a bit of an underdog in the FBI in that she walks into an elevator and everyone in there is a foot taller than her.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's a very naturalistic look.
Yeah.
It's a very naturalistic style. Everything's rather, you know, rather straightforward. And then
Hannibal's operatic.
Yeah. Let me say that, you know, Silence of the Lambs, it's very downbeat. It's very downbeat. All the violence happens off screen, you know, like there's a lot of blood, but, you know, it's never like gratuitous. And then there's Hannibal, which, yeah, you described it as operatic. Like, that thing is so over the top, but it's gorgeous because that's its goal. It's the way that Hannibal treats death is like murder is like the most fucked up art project in the world. People murder each other. People murder as a form of self-expression. Mm-hmm. That's why they do it.
Yeah, so, I majored like, all in
of,
it.
So, yeah. So, like, all of the death scenes are, like, really exquisitely fucked up, but you can understand what the person doing it is trying to achieve through that. And it especially gets crazy, especially in season two, where there's one that, like, actually, like, shook me to the core. There was nothing okay about that.
Yeah, and there's one. Season two of Hannibal actually got an audible scream out of me.
Yep. Oh, season three. I can't wait. Dude, I can't wait for you to watch season three. There was one
I might start watching season three tonight.
Yeah, season three has one scene that I was like, if there was a rating for the FCC in terms of absolute unacceptability on television, this is it. That was nightmare fuel.
The fact that got on NBC.
NBC, as much as I want to rag on them about it, they gave it so much leeway and they allowed so many things that other people wouldn't have. But I'm just
I looked at the ratings and I'm like, wow, this was never a big popular show.
This was never a hit.
Like, I think the most it ever had was like 4-something.
Yeah,
which
that's
for
it.
a you know, network channel show is like, you know, Bob's Burgers is one thing. Something that's probably really as elaborate and probably expensive as Hannibal.
NBC wasn't the ones financing it. It was Sony.
Yeah,
right?
It was Gaumont International, which is a French-Canadian company.
Being
fans of Hannibal, you're a fan of world cinema.
See, exactly. I mean, because by the end of its run, like season three, there's episodes that get less than 1 million viewers.
Yeah, well, I think by that point, they decided that they knew that the axe was coming. And Brian Fuller was like, listen, rather than trying to tone it down and win more people, we're never going to win these people. Let's just go balls out.
And Brian Fuller's like, hey, at least I made more than six episodes, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so thing, when Brian Fuller was talking about, like, here's what I'm going to do with season four, I was thinking, can you count the four?
Yeah, no, that's when he said, like, I have, like, a seven-season plan, and I was like, Brian, stop.
You should know from your own fucking history.
I just want to point out, you think Hannibal is going to get more seasons than Wonderfalls got episodes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, is Hannibal his longest running show?
Yes.
Yes, it is. By one season.
Yes.
He broke the two-season rule only by
Pushing
one.
Pushing Daisies was two seasons, right?
Yeah, it had two seasons.
Was two seasons, but granted, one of them got shortened by a writer's strike.
Which is which is still impressive compared to Amazing Screw-On Head, which never made it past the pilot.
Yep. Poor Brian Fuller. But that dude's awesome anyways. He seems to be enjoying life.
You would think they would just let him do shit the way it's like, how many of his shows are huge cult faves?
That's saying, I'm willing to bet that that's kind of where they're at, where it's like, Brian Fuller, we know you. We know you make good stuff. We really want to see something you do actually make money, so we're going to try giving you a new show. We're going to let you do what you want. And then it just doesn't make money, so they have to cancel it.
Well, I know he's doing American Gods on Stars.
He's
doing American Gods, so that should help him out.
Yeah, which considering it's a network or a cable show.
Yeah, then that'll help him out a lot.
Yeah.
Something with HBO or something, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, exactly. But anyways, I was going to say that, like, Hannibal is, rather than having like a subtle Howard Shore score, it's got Soundscapes from Hell by Brian Reitzell. You know, like that. I buy every soundtrack for that show that I can because it's incredible. You know, everything about it is stylized. Everything about it's hallucinatory. So my last girlfriend, when I was telling her about like why she should watch Hannibal and I wanted to be the one to show her, was because Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal are night and day. Like, one of them is very realistic and naturalistic, and the other one is hallucinatory. So they both achieve the same things, but by going about it in completely radically different ways. And they're both great companion pieces. It's like, you know, when I found out they were doing Red Dragon for season three, they were bumping it up. I was like, oh my God, that was the one thing that was the only thing I wanted from this whole series, was them doing Red Dragon. Because, you know, Red Dragon has been adapted twice, and one of them was, you know, 80s style. Excuse me, one of them was 80s cheese. The other one was just like, yeah, but this is, I've already seen Silence of the Lambs, so why bother? Because it's Brett Ratner. So when it's like, hey, we're going to adapt Red Dragon, but we're going to make it like, you know, hallucinatory and nightmarish and just completely like Lynchian, I'm like, well, you had me there. So, and it lived up to that. It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that was really what I wanted to come on and talk about, was just how they both achieved the same goals by being completely different from one another, and it's all the better for it.
Which for my money, unless until I prove otherwise, is the way you're going to need to adapt, especially horror movies, if you're going to do a reimagination in this day and age. Do something different to get the same results.
Yeah, exactly.
Thing I noticed with it when I was watching the pilot earlier today, again. Oh, why'd I have to swallow that cigarette today?
I don't know.
But the pilot, I caught one movie reference in it, and it wasn't a Silence of the Lambs movie. It was the fact that the bathroom looks like The Shining.
Oh, God. Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, where Lawrence Fishburne, is that where he says, like, go to the ladies' room?
Yeah, which that's the other thing about it. I think Brian Fuller, at a point, sometimes forgets that he's not writing a comedy when he's writing Hannibal, and I mean that in the best possible way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it has personality.
Yeah, it has a lot of personality. There's moments where you want to laugh, but you're nervous. Like the scene that got a scream out of me was in the – and I'm not going to spoil it for Taylor because I hope you're going to keep watching it.
It stinks. I hate it.
I'll just call it Justice is Blind.
Yep.
I started off as a laugh, and then as that got revealed, the laugh went from
Yep. Oh, yeah. There's the cello scene. Aren't you glad I reminded you of that?
So anyway, you guys got some closing thoughts so we can wrap this shit up?
They're both great. Watch them. Fuck you.
Yeah, and fuck you. Go watch these.
Just a recap on, just a recap on what you can learn from them. Just because you're telling a story that's designed just to scare people doesn't mean that you have to give in to genre norms. You can actually do something really creative. And just because a horror movie doesn't mean it can't win great awards and be universally acclaimed and be the best movie to ever come out on Valentine's Day. You can do something great as long as you put effort into it, no matter what you're doing. And then if you have to redo that for the sake of appeasing people who want to make money, yeah, do something creative with that too.
I'm gonna quote Casey and just say, fucking watch it already. And I'm gonna watch more Hannibal. It's just I need to finish some other stuff first, because I'm watching Bloodline right now and I need to finish that shit. It's a good show. Fucking watch it. It's got blood in the title. That's horror related, right?
I know nothing about Bloodline, so
it's really good. It's from the creators of Damages. It's got Kyle Chandler.
That's not a selling point for me.
Well, I mean, Damages was good for a couple seasons.
I'm not being hyperbolic there. My uncle was the killer on Damages, so.
So there you go. Maybe he's going to be the killer in Bloodline. I don't know. It could fucking happen. Spoiler, so anyway. Casey's uncle's like Kyle Chandler.
So anyway.
Also, Casey's uncle killed Kyle Chandler in the show Bloodline.
Yep, there you go. He played both. He played both the Kyle Chandler's killer and Kyle Chandler. There you go. Anyway, well, hopefully this has been an enjoyable experience for you listeners. Thank you. Hopefully we can do more what you can learn from Ellipses. And thank you, Casey, for approaching me with the idea. We've got a couple of things we can.
Thank you for taking me.
Say that again?
Thank you for taking me up on it 6 months later.
Yep. Not even on the subject you wanted to do.
One day I'll get my Quadrophenia, what you can learn from.
Nope. I veto that.
Neil's just anyway, happy to be here, and I'm just happy they let me out of my cage.
We hope we sold you on, if you haven't seen either Hannibal or Silence of the Lambs, why the fuck are you listening to this? But spoiler alert. But hopefully it makes you want to revisit him if you have seen him and you haven't watched him in a while. And hopefully this has gotten you a little bit in the Halloween mood. So. I guess happy Halloween, listeners from Geeks at Large, and from here on out, we'll remain at large. Right, guys?
I'm trying to come up with a spooky way to finish this.
Don't!